The Fan on Demand.
Good Thursday evening, everybody. I'm Roger Lajoie, along with Tom Tebbett of Tennis Canada, and this is the final edition for this tennis season of Aces on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Great to have you with us. Thanks so much for supporting the show throughout the course of the year. We're going to wrap up the show with a couple of good interviews. Jimmy Arias, world's former number five player, will be on the program a little bit later. We'll have Tom's mailbag with questions that you've given Tom throughout the course of the season in our last segment. And we're going to start with the referee of the U.S. Open, where we find Tom Tebbett in New York City. Tom, how you doing?
Great, Roger. How are you?
Great. It's been an interesting U.S. Open, maybe 60 seconds. The big story was a Roddick retirement and Federer losing. A word about both those.
Well, I mean, I think Roddick had a good run. I didn't really think he was going to beat Del Potro. Del Potro is just too young and too good for him. So, good show. I mean, he's been an entertaining player, a very good player, not a great player probably if you compare it to Federer, Nadal, etc. But nice to see him get his due as he's leaving. And I'm not too surprised about Federer. I've always thought that Berdych is one of the guys that can beat him. He's got such a big game when he plays well. I think Roger knows that. Federer didn't play his best last night, but nice to see Berdych through. He's got the talent to win a Grand Slam, but has he got the head?
We'll find out soon enough. Okay, let's get right to our first interview. Tell us about the referee of the U.S. Open, Brian Early.
Well, we had the referee of Wimbledon a few months ago, Andrew Jarrett, so it's fun to have Brian Early, and he's been faced with a few problems over the years, and I tried to ask him about some of those in the interview I did with him earlier today.
And here is Tom's conversation with Brian Early.
Brian Early, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you for having me.
The U.S. Open, always a very busy time, a lot of things happening. How has the U.S. Open been for you so far this year?
Been very good, very good. We had a few rain issues recently, and players have been amazingly cooperative, and got a little lucky yesterday with the rain stoppage a little earlier than predicted, and we got all the matches back on track.
What can you do before the tournament starts to try to ensure it works as well as possible?
Well, you do a lot of contingency planning because there are a lot of things happen that you don't know, that you never know. So what you do is you take all of those experiences that you've had and then try to plan even worst case scenarios than you've ever had, and that serves you well when you get to those things that you couldn't predict.
How long have you been the referee of the U.S. Open?
This is my 20th year as the tournament referee of the U.S. Open, and I've been on the referee staff for 32.
And what would be the most challenging year you've had so far?
The most challenging year was, I believe, the year Roddick won, so that was 2003. And that was the year we played, I believe, in a four-day period, we played. We completed four matches, I believe.
And what would you say your tournament, the U.S. Open, compared to being the referee here, say compared to being the referee at the Australian Open, the French Open, and Wimbledon, what would be the differences?
Well, I would say that the most comparable event is the Australian Open because they have split sessions, and that's from a ticketing perspective, which really impacts my job, which is to make sure that those two sessions are totally separated. Now, the advantage that Wayne McEwen, my counterpart at the Australian Open, the advantage that he has is he can close the roof. But that doesn't mean that he's without issues as well. I mean, they had the 4:35 a.m. finish one time. So they have their own set of problems, but at the same time, it's very, very similar, very comparable to the U.S. Open. Wimbledon has its issues because they don't start their stadium court and their what they call the center court. They don't start that court until 1 in the afternoon, and that sometimes makes challenges at the end of the day. The French Open, they have some advantages because they can play in the rain a little bit. They can play in a little bit of sprinkle, but at the same time, their matches go longer because they're played on clay. So each of its tournaments has its own color, its own flavor, and its own challenges.
Are you a tennis player yourself?
I play a little bit. I don't know what you would do, what you would, how you would gauge it in Canada. I'm probably a B player, a low B player. I was a reasonably good club player, but I didn't play in college, and I wasn't a ranked junior or anything like that.
But as a player, when you go out on the court and a guy's complaining about the umpire didn't hear a let, or there was some mistake in terms of judgment on a line call or something like that, does it help to actually play the game to sort of have a bit of sympathy for the player?
Well, I think it helps. It helps a little, but the fact that I've been an official for 34 years, I think that helps a whole lot more. There are many former players who get into positions of get into referee or officiating positions, and they have their own way that they remember how they reacted to things, and maybe they don't take the temperature of the individual player as well, because they have their own preconceived notions. I would hope that those of us who, whether or not we've been players in the past, we have listened to players and over the years that we've officiated, and taken that into consideration when we make our future decisions.
As somebody who's well acquainted with all the rules of tennis, obviously the greatest innovation in the last 5, 6, 7 years has been Hawkeye, the electronic line calling system, which is used during matches. What do you think of it, and how has it changed your job in any way?
Well, it's added one more layer and one less layer. The line calls themselves are less contentious, so that's a good thing. It does have its own issues that it brings up, like whether or not you play a let on a particular point that has been challenged and overturned. How soon the player challenges, and we've had a little bit of fine tuning in that regard. The wording in the protocol this year has changed to must show immediate interest, and so that has. There are some controversy occasionally when a challenge is denied by a chair umpire. It has helped generally, and it has really helped in terms of the entertainment value. And I think it's highly, highly unlikely that one particular call will change the outcome of a match. That doesn't mean that it won't, and you know, depending on when the challenge came and if the player were sure enough to actually stop a point, there are still those kinds of issues, but it really, really minimizes that part of it.
You're in charge of all the officiating as the referee. Would you get together with all the umpires before the tournament starts and maybe establish some guidelines or just refresh them about anything that's new for the particular year?
Absolutely, yes. We meet with them. I meet with them on the first morning of the tournament, and we talk about different ways kind of the ground rules at the U.S. Open with balls in the stands, and we talk about medical protocols. We talk about different things that have happened during the summer during the U.S. Open series. Emirates Airline U.S. Open Series, and what we've learned from that over the summer, and it's really a valuable meeting, and we get a lot of input from them, and hopefully we give them some guidance as well.
You mentioned about balls into the stands. What's the policy on that?
The top three courts, that would be Ash, Armstrong, and Grandstand, are what we call fan friendly. And that's a quote from our PR folks. People in the stands can keep the balls, and when the players hit them there, and the chair umpire replaces them with a ball, what we call a ball of like wear.
I thought I saw a ball boy throwing a ball into the stands, maybe to get the good ball back and give them another ball. Is that a policy as well?
It is not. It's a rather informal policy. It depends. If a chair umpire feels that he or she is low on, doesn't have a ball that is close enough to the balls that are in play, he or she might offer that to offer another ball that has been used at some other time during the match, but doesn't quite match up with the balls that are in play, might offer that as an exchange. But that's a rather informal, and a chair umpire has to be really hurting for balls that match up and needs that ball back.
I guess the prickliest question that always comes up every year whenever there's any rain is the question of a roof or covers on the court. And these questions I hear all the time, so I'm going to ask you two. First off, why don't they have actual covers on the court that just lie flat on the court? I think I know the answer, but I'm interested.
We've we've tried not covers here, but we've tried covers at other tournaments, and quite frankly, they work okay on outside courts that you're not getting to. If you could put tarps on every court, like inflatable tarps, like they do at Wimbledon, on every court, then you would probably get the lower courts that you don't get to drive as get, you know, you don't get your crews out to quite as quickly because you're prioritizing the top three or four for television. But at the same time, our experience is that tarps on the big courts, if you can get to them quickly with crews, with blowers, with the court drying equipment that with the sophisticated court drying equipment we have, that it doesn't change the court drying time, because remember that you have to inflate them, you have to deflate them, you have to get them off the court, you have to store them. There is water that would be produced around the court when you roll them up, because they are wet when you take them down. And all in all, you don't save any real time.
And of course, the other question is the roof. Obviously, a roof would solve the problem totally, but I know there's some architectural and technical problems about putting a roof over such an immense structure as Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Absolutely, yes. I wish we could go back in time and say, okay, we're going to build a structure that will accommodate a roof if we decide to have one. That's not something that the powers that be here at the U.S. Open seriously considered in 1989 and 90 when the initial discussions were, initial planning was taking place. So we have a facility that can't accommodate a roof with the current technology that is out there. And we are open always to proposals from people, and have gotten a few proposals over the years that looked fairly workable, but ended up in the final analysis not being workable as far as adding a roof onto the stadium. We still aren't there yet, but we're still entertaining proposals, and we've got drawings and illustrations and documents that have been sent to us, and we're looking as closely as we can at everyone, and we would love to have a roof. At this point, we're not there.
I've heard that the space to cover actually is five times greater than Wimbledon. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, that's a number that we like to talk about, because people say, oh yeah, they have a few thousand fewer people that they can hold in there, but at the same time they have a roof and you don't. And I said, yeah, well, for five times the actual square feet. Yeah, we would have to spend X number of dollars and retrofit, and it's just, there's so much goes into it. It's a comparison that runs out of steam.
And just maybe a last question. Part of your job, obviously, is dealing with the players. Is there a little kid in you sometimes that thinks, geez, I'm talking to Roger Federer or Rafael Nadal or Djokovic or Serena or Maria? Is there a little kid that pops up and thinks, holy smokes, what am I doing here?
No, never. No, I don't think that ever goes into my mind. I think part of that has to do too with the fact that I've seen these players before they became Roger Federer and Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova. I followed them coming up through the ranks, and they were other players who then happened to stand out later in their careers. I'll tell you what does happen though is when Tiger Woods comes into my office to meet Roger Federer, and I go, and there's a little kid in me who comes out and says, "Oh, that's Tiger Woods in my office," because I never paid any attention to golf, and then all of a sudden Tiger Woods was a big name, and it's the same with celebrities who happen to come in, and I say, "Well, yeah," so that's when the little kid in me comes out.
Brian Early, thanks for being on the show tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks to Brian Early, referee of the U.S. Open, and Tom Tebbit. This segment of Aces is brought to you by Tennis Canada, home of the Rogers Cup in Toronto and in Montreal. For tickets throughout the course of the season and all information, visit rogerscup.com. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom and I are back in moments with Jimmy Arias, former number 5 world-ranked player. You're listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. You're listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm Roger Lajoie. And Tom Tebbit, thanks for all of your great support this season on Aces. We'll have lots of off-season news and tennis on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Tom's going to join me in studio on a Saturday coming up as well. But this is our final edition, and we thank our sponsors, in particular, especially Corona, because this segment of Aces is brought to you by Corona Extra, the official beer sponsor of the ATP Tour. Corona Extra, ready to serve, ATP World Tour premier partner. Tom, you were a busy guy down in New York. Jimmy Arias, boy, there was a great player in his day, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He was lots of fun. And one thing about Jimmy Arias, I think Canadians are familiar with him from the commentary he did for Rogers Sportsnet and for CBC during the Rogers Cup. One thing about Jimmy Arias, you wind him up and he talks.
We'll find that out for sure in a minute, because here's Tom's conversation with the one, the only, Jimmy Arias.
Jimmy Arias, welcome to Aces.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You grew up in Buffalo, which isn't far from Toronto, and you live in Florida now. But when you look back, what was your connection to Toronto when you were growing up?
Well, a couple of things. I think, one, I played the Canadian Nationals. I don't know exactly how that happened, how I was allowed to play. I played Martin Wostenholm in the finals of the 12 and under Canadian Nationals, and I got him in straight sets. And we used to play something in Buffalo called the Marsh Cup, which was between Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Toronto. So we always played another club that brought a team. And the other thing was, because I was almost Niagara Falls, I was even closer to Canada. And the one tournament I went to as a kid to watch as a fan was the Canadian Open when I was young. So I always had an affinity, obviously, for the Canadians.
This is a bit of a funny question, but you were ranked as high as number 5 in 1984. How did you get to be that high? What got you there all through your junior years and in your professional years as well?
Well, there's a few things, obviously, that have to go your way for that to happen. But one of the things was, first of all, I had a sort of a newish shot with my forehand that was a little more of a weapon than what most people were hitting. So I had a unique shot that was advantageous for me, number one. Number two, I didn't realize this till later on, but I did have a ton of confidence. I thought that, and I wasn't cocky about it, I don't think, but I thought that I would be number one in the world someday. So from 8 years old till it was obvious I wasn't going to be number one in the world someday, I thought I would be number one in the world. So making it, I think if you set the goals that high, you have a chance to do pretty good things. And I think that's basically the main thing, is that I truly believed. I remember winning the French Open mixed doubles as a 16-year-old and pretending like I was excited, but I knew it was mixed doubles. And I pretended I was excited because I thought to myself, I'm going to win 5 of these in singles. So it just gives you an idea of how you expect great things to happen. Maybe they can.
In 1983, you won the Italian Open as an 18-year-old. That's a very prestigious title. Would that be the highlight of your career?
That's hard to answer, too. Yes, that's one of them, certainly. That's one that I remember. But for me, really, it was the semifinals at the U.S. Open later that year, because I put so much pressure on myself for the U.S. Open. This was the one I told you I went to Canada to watch the Canadian Open. I also came to New York to watch the U.S. Open. Those were the two tournaments I came to as a kid and felt a lot of pressure here, had family that would, and people from Buffalo coming all the time to watch me play. And when I saw the draw that I didn't have McEnroe, Connors, or Lendl in my section, I thought this is a chance for me to make at least the semifinals. That's a point where I actually set my sights a little too low. I set my sights for semis. Once I made it, I didn't know why I was playing in the semis. As far as I was concerned, I'd won the tournament.
You were listed at 5'9", 155 pounds. How much different would your career have been if you were like Roger Federer and Pete Sampras and were 6'1"?
Well, yeah, obviously that would be a help to be a little taller. You're not getting a lot of free points on your serve, those type of things. A couple extra inches, you have a little more reach. You got a little more speed probably at that height. I think that's the perfect height for tennis, 6'1", 6'2". At least that's what it's been in the past. So obviously I'd love to have that, but considering my dad was 5'4 and my mom was 5'2", I'm an absolute giant.
Way back when, 1988, as a matter of fact, I think it was in June or July of that year, you were playing a tournament in the Laurentians north of Montreal, and I did a long interview with you. I think it was a rain delay or something. So we talked for a long time, talked about a lot of stuff. And one of the things you told me about was that you started out changing your backhand, and you'd had a six-month experiment to try to change your backhand, which did not work out. Can you sort of remember that and tell me about why it happened?
Well, basically in 1984, after I was sick with mono for 3 months, I lost my biggest weapon, which was my forehand. Not to where it still wasn't effective, but I wasn't hitting clean winners any longer. So at some point I realized maybe I'm not getting the forehand quite back to where I want it, where I'm going to win points. My whole game was set up to get a high forehand. I hit the ball high and heavy, and I got a high forehand, then I hit as hard as I could. That was the basic strategy. When I realized that, I was no longer just smashing forehands. I was playing a little more like Roddick without the big serve. So I'd hit a heavy forehand, but not a clean winner any longer. And you can't beat the better players without a clean winner. So I thought, maybe I can turn my backhand into a weapon. And I knew my grip wasn't conducive to crushing my backhand. So I decided to try changing my grip. But it's a huge change. You have to change your contact point when you change your grip. And it's hard to do that on the fly while you're still on the tour playing. And I went from when I made that change, I was 30 in the world, and by 6 months in, I was 150, hadn't won a match in 6 months. Trying to change back, by the way, after that 6 months, trying to find my backhand. It probably took me 2 years to hit a backhand in the court after that.
So it didn't work out.
It did not work out well, although somehow I still managed to end the year. I would think I was still top 100 in the world and then got back to 50 in the world. I'm amazed when I look back at my career that I with all the things that happened in that situation, losing my backhand, I ended up not having a serve by the end. I was double faulting, so I started just spinning that in at 85 miles an hour, make sure I got the first serve in. My whole game disappeared, but somehow I still had a couple of things that allowed me to stay in the top 100 all that time. And that was, you know, I fought hard, tried my heart out, and I ran well. So if you run well, I could always hit the forehand in at least also.
I remember in that interview you talked about your relationship with your father. He was very demanding of you tennis-wise when you were a kid. Looking back on that now, how do you sort of analyze that relationship?
Well, I think in my mind, I'm grateful to him for the fact that he's the one who demanded greatness for me and not to be satisfied. That was, I'm not sure if the dream of number one was mine or his, to tell you the truth, because it started so young. I'm sure some of it was his, or a lot of it was him planted into me. And I remember a couple of things that were funny about my dad that just gives you the idea that never to be satisfied was the way he wanted me to be. The first one was I was playing a guy named Jose Luis Clerc, who was ranked 4 in the world at the time. I was 17 years old. I hadn't yet had a big win. I called him up. I beat him in the semifinals of a Washington tournament and called my dad and said, Dad, I just beat Clerc. Can you believe it? He goes, you should be Clerc. Who do you play now? I said, Lendl. He said, don't even call me if you don't beat Lendl. That was an idea of, okay, so you beat Clerc, so what? Now you've got Lendl. Get ready for Lendl. Think about that match. The other one that kind of cracks me up was because it was at the Canadian Open, and I hadn't been playing well. And all of a sudden at that tournament, I got hot. I think it was Montreal. I'm not sure if it was Toronto or Montreal. I think it was Montreal. And I beat Kevin Curran in 85 in the third round, and he was coming off finals of Wimbledon. And in the quarters, I beat Elliot Telcher, who was ranked top 10 at the time. So I beat maybe number 5 in the world, number 8 or 9 in the world, and I was playing Lendl in the semis, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to beat Lendl, so I thought I'll call my dad now after I beat Telcher. Remember, I haven't been playing well. I'm ranked 30. I call him up, Dad, yeah, how you doing? He said, how'd you do today? I said, I won. He said, well, who'd you play? Telcher. What was the score? 7-6, 6-1. 7-6? He got mad that I went to tiebreak. He got mad at the score like he used to in the juniors. It was just sort of funny to me. No matter what, he didn't want me to be satisfied.
You played McEnroe a few times. I remember you telling me once that you were about ready to strangle him because he hit a smash right at you. What kind of a relationship do you have with him now that you're both sort of in the same business in some ways, playing senior events and also doing some broadcasting?
Where's this interview going to? Look, the bottom line is we've had our moments, some of them my fault, some of them his fault, where we didn't get along. And I think for the most part, for about 5 years now, we've been pretty good. And hopefully whatever I say here in this interview, it'll stay that way because he does have power in tennis, first of all. He's the biggest name in the game, really, even now. I mean, I know Federer and those guys are bigger, but as far as who can influence me, McEnroe's the guy. So we've gotten along fine. We're better than we ever were.
If they'd had Hawkeye in the days when McEnroe was playing, would he have been allowed to be as crazy as he was?
No. He would. Connors and him both would have had, I'm not saying they wouldn't have had the same career exactly, but they both got a lot of really good calls. I'm sure there were some matches that were lost to them because of line calls. They went about it two totally different ways. I'm not exactly sure why Connors got so many good calls, but he did. And McEnroe did it by, if he hit it out by 6 inches or 8 inches, he'd yell at you like you were an idiot. So that when he only missed it by 3 inches, they thought, whoa, I better call this one in. So he seemed to get a lot of good calls because of that as well. Hawkeye, obviously, that would have been the end of any of that stuff. He wouldn't have been able. Plus, McEnroe used it for momentum swings. If you were on a good swing, playing well, all of a sudden he could feel the momentum going against him. He would argue a ridiculous call for 5 minutes. He knew he was wrong. He's just arguing it to change up the momentum.
How much do you enjoy doing broadcasting this year? A lot of people thought you did a great job at the Rogers Cup for Sportsnet and for CBC.
I enjoy it. I enjoy watching how great these players are today, to tell you the truth, and trying to figure out what needs to be done to each person. I like the strategy, and I like seeing, more than anything, I can feel when a player's starting to get tight. I know what generally happens when you're feeling that way, and I know it happens at certain scores and things, and I like to try to make predictions about that kind of thing and which way the momentum's going. That I like to see that in a match.
Are there any golden rules of broadcasting that you've learned over the years since when you first started doing it?
No, that's one of the problems with me. I don't seem to learn those type of things. I just watch and say what I think. Sometimes that works out really well. Every once in a while, players get mad at me, but, you know, what can you do?
This is meant a little bit in jest, but is Roger Federer as good as everybody thinks?
Is he as good as he thinks? No, okay. Yes, he's incredible. He's this last Wimbledon win to me is the one that put him over the top for greatest of all time. I wasn't willing to put him there personally, only because his main rival, which is still the case really, but his main rival during his big years was a guy that beat him consistently when they played each other. So how can you be called the greatest of all time when you can't beat the guy you're competing against, really? And that's Nadal, obviously, is the guy that kept getting the best of him. But the longevity, the consistency, and now just the sheer number of titles is incredible. And the way he plays is amazing to watch.
You have a 16-year-old son that you play tennis with sometime. What's that like? And do you have flashbacks to when you were playing and your father was around?
I understand my dad much better than I did. You know, now that I have my own son and he doesn't listen to me, it absolutely drives me insane. Having said that, my dad was an electrical engineer, so he wasn't a tennis pro. So for me not to listen to him wasn't as egregious as my son not listening to me right now. We have a different relationship than my dad and I have, and I haven't put any pressure on him. And I think in some ways he's upset at me for that. He feels as though I should have pushed him, that he's now behind and he wants to be a good player, but he hasn't put in any of the work to get there. And, you know, he can't start late in this sport, at least at 16, 15, 16. That's a little too late.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for being on the show tonight.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Jimmy Arias in conversation with Tom Tebbit at the U.S. Open. I'm Roger Lajoie. When we return, coming up, Tom's Mailbag, your final chance for questions for Tom Tebbit. We'll read your questions. Coming up next, you're listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
It's Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom Tebbit along, as always, from Tennis Canada. This segment of Aces is brought to you by the National Bank. At National Bank, we know that you can't win without strong service. That's why we're proud to sponsor the 2012 Rogers Cup. Visit winningexchanges.ca for details. Tom and I have been with you throughout the course of the tennis season. We can't thank you enough, folks. And we're going to thank one lucky winner in particular, because somebody is taking home that Wilson BLX racket, Tom, because our mystery sounders throughout the course of our Aces broadcast throughout the course of the year had a pile of winners. And we're going to announce a winner just before we leave.
Sounds good, Rog. hopefully that racket will help somebody play a little bit better tennis.
Let's hope so, because it's a good one for sure, and we'll have that for you a little bit later in the program. But now, Tom, for time for Tom's mailbag, and the response you've given us all year, folks, has just been so terrific for this, and we cannot thank you enough. And we've had so many, and we won't get to everybody who had questions for Tom, because I asked via Twitter and email throughout the course of the week for questions for us. And Tom, I know so many of our listeners have had their chance. I'm going to try to get some new ones on here because we've had so many people who have been involved here. But I know you want to give a word of thanks to all the people who sent in questions throughout the course of the year. And you know what? We had some great questions.
We did. I was always surprised it wasn't sort of, you know, what's Roger Federer really like, or is Maria Sharapova as pretty as she looks, or stuff like that. It was good hardcore tennis questions.
What is he really like, and is she as pretty? Oh, sorry. That was the dumb questions I was asking. Let's get to the email, and again, thank you all for your terrific questions. Brian emails in and says, guys, enjoyed the program very much. Hope to see you back for another season, and well done. And Brian, thank you. You always have something nice to say for sure. Does the recent upset of Federer earlier at the U.S. Open and the fact that Nadal is hurt really change the landscape in tennis? And will it make it easier for Milos Raonic perhaps to move up even higher in the standings if these guys get off their games anymore? Brian, thanks. Tom, I got to tell you, I think, you know, Federer losing in the U.S. Open is startling. But fact of the matter is the top players in the world are still pretty tough.
Yeah, I'm not totally startled about Berdych. They were three. I think one point Federer was 8-0 after losing to him in the Olympics in 2004. But the last six meetings have been three each way, and I know that he's a very difficult player for Federer to play against. And so I'm not shocked by that result. I don't think it's that surprising. And you know, I never got that down on Federer a year or two ago when everybody thought he was finished, and I didn't want to get too high on him when he's obviously had a great year this year, winning Wimbledon, being in the final of the Olympics. But you know, Berdych is a tough guy to play. And he kind of lay in the weeds all summer long, didn't play well at Wimbledon, didn't play well at the Olympics, didn't play that well in Cincinnati or Toronto, but has really found his game here, and he's a tough guy to play, but he's not that consistent. So I think that's a good question. I think it definitely does. You never know about Nadal's health, and Federer probably isn't going to get better at this point. So it is an opening for Milos maybe to move in there in the next year or two.
Well, and all those guys are ahead of him in the rankings, worth pointing out for sure. Good question, and thank you. Donald, another regular listener, emails in and says, guys, did the bad weather that plagued the Rogers Cup in Toronto have a bad financial impact on the Rogers Cup? It must be really tough for the organizers. And we talk so much about how important weather, good weather is for walk-up at baseball or football or any outdoor stadiums. But for tennis in particular, I got to believe it was a difficult deal. Could you share any info on that? Thank you, Donald. I don't think we have any particular financial info per se, Tom, but definitely when it rains, it pours at a tennis tournament. It's got to be really tough for the organizers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Tennis Canada took a hit. They certainly took a hit in comparison to what their projections were for the tournament. And one thing I found interesting was watching the Cincinnati tournament the week after Toronto. They talked about having, and they were a bit fortunate because they did have Federer there, and obviously he's a huge draw, but they had 40% walk-up. 40% of their ticket sales were walk-up. And I think with the bad weather and the disappointment of Federer not being there, and then Murray, you know, really, I think he did a great thing just by showing up, but he went out, and of course Nadal didn't play, and so, you know, that was a disappointment, and there was virtually probably no walk-up in Toronto. So it's not hard to figure out that it was a tough year, but, you know, the Olympics only comes once every 4 years, and I think the next 3 years should, you know, obviously be much better.
Here's hoping. Can't control the weather, but yeah, that was just bad luck. Kind of like the Blue Jays injuries this year. When it rains, it really does pour for sure. Another question similar on that comes from Kevin, who adds, guys, is the book still open on the possibility of Montreal and Toronto having the tournaments in different weeks as they did? I've heard you guys talk about it on Aces many times, and it looks like it's here to stay. But I really do wonder if this is the best thing for Tennis Canada. Thank you for the question. Tom, we've discussed this before. It really is out of the hand of Tennis Canada, right? This is a tennis governing body decision.
Well, Roger, that's another good question. It is. I don't think it's entirely impossible. But what would have to happen is that they'd have to move the women back to the week before the men. So the men is 3 weeks now before the U.S. Open. The women used to be 2 weeks before, but obviously Cincinnati took that week for their mixed tournament. So we're now men and women in the third week for the U.S. Open. But I think the option would be to have the women the fourth week before the U.S. Open, and then the men in Montreal or Toronto the third week before, and then you go back to the system of having 2 weeks, you know, 1 week featuring the men and 1 week featuring the women. So I think that's definitely something that Tennis Canada will consider, but I don't think the change could be made, at least for certainly not for next year, possibly for 2014 or 2015.
Okay, we'll see. Something to keep an eye on for sure. It's Aces. I'm Roger Lajoie. Tom Tebbit with you. We're moments away from announcing the winner of our Wilson BLX racket. So stick around for that. And we'll give you one more mystery sounder as well, just to have some fun. No prize this week, but see who's the smart people out there. And I think there'll be a lot of smart people out there. Angie's got an interesting question regarding tennis in Canada, Tom. Tom, I've really enjoyed the show. You and Roger have done a nice job with Aces, and thanks for bringing the show to the air. It's good to see a regular dedicated tennis show. Angie, thank you very much for that. It's a long email, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. She gets into the young Canadian junior tennis players and asks Tom, Raonic, of course, is getting all the pub, and rightfully so, and he's really moving up on the rankings. Are we on the verge of a real renaissance in Canadian tennis where we'll see several Canadians jump up? It seems like we have so many good junior players. That's another good question. How good are these Canadian juniors, Tom?
Well, obviously, Pelly Wo and Eugenie Bouchard won the boys and girls events at Wimbledon this year. That's a terrific sign. And, you know, they're both very good players. Today, unfortunately, both Bouchard and Françoise Abanda, who's equally, I think, promising, because Françoise is only 15 years old, and she won the tournament in Repentigny, the Canadian Junior International, last week. And that's a big preparation tournament for the U.S. Open, but she lost today, actually, after winning the first set 6-love. And the same thing happened to Bouchard. She won the first set, I think, 6-1, and then she went down and to an American. So I thought it was tough for Bouchard. You know, I mean, she's been doing very well out on the women's tour. And this American is the U.S. junior champion. She's only 16. She had nothing to lose. She actually had a wild card in the main draw, played Clijsters. So she played all kinds of, you know, sort of good matches to get her ready for this. And I think all the pressure was on Bouchard. So it'll be fun to see next week. There's a tournament in Quebec City, the Bell Challenge, which is a fun tournament. Both Bouchard will be playing main draw and Abanda will be playing in the qualifying. But they're really promising. And as I mentioned, you know, Pelly Wo has shown that he's a very good player and he's a terrific fighter.
Really encouraging and nice to see for sure. Peter emails in and also enjoying the show. And Peter, thank you. And it's great all of you say that. And we do appreciate it once again. Can't say enough for you. He wants to know, and this is interesting. We haven't talked about this, Tom. And again, it's another long email, but the gist of it, and Peter, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to paraphrase here, but basically his question revolves around player personalities. We had McEnroe back in the day, Roddick now retiring. You know, the guys who were colorful, Agassi when he was younger, the screamers, the yellers, all that kind of stuff. He says, the world has some really great tennis players now, but are we ever going to see another McEnroe-type player in our era? Or is it a case because of the way things are with Twitter and the way things are magnified, the real personality of players can't get out? Because, and he goes on to say that he really enjoys today's player, but by comparison, Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic are pretty boring compared to some of the wild guys who were around there. Are there any more wild guys left in tennis, or are we going to see the end of that, Tom? What do you think?
Oh, well, there's a few. There's a few that have kind of quirky personalities. I'm trying to think right now, but I know just even at the tournament here, there's a player from France who does kind of goofy things, Benoit Paire, who I'd never heard of before, and he was pretty goofy. I watched one of his matches. It was really a treat the other night after things. I finished working, just went out and watched for fun, and he played a great match against a German player. And so there definitely are still a person. It was Cole Schreiber who played. It was a really fun match, and he does goofy things like change his shoes in the middle of a game, and then he leave the old shoes on the court, and he's good at smacking rackets and tossing balls over the back fence and stuff like that. So there's still lots of guys around, but listen, let's face it, I was there, McEnroe, Connors, Garolitis, Nastasi, they were jerks.
Yeah.
They were jerks. I mean, and the thing is now, you have Hawkeye, that's the main thing they use to cause a scene was to, you know.
Right, the call. So how can you do it now? Yeah.
You can't do it now. Yeah. So, I think it's much fairer that people get on with it. They play tennis. And really, there were never any gentlemen to the point that these four guys you think of now, Murray, Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer, they're just first class tennis citizens. And it's maybe too bad that they don't go a little bit haywire now and then. But I think it's much better for the sport to have four such respectable guys at the top.
Well, you're so right about the Hawkeye system. It does change it. And what are you going to argue about when it's black and white? White like that for sure. Time for maybe two more, and then we'll get to our little sounder and have some fun with that. And the Wilson BX, BLX tennis racket winner as well. Mac is a regular listener and wants a question about the ranking system. Says, guys, I really don't understand how it works. Well, and then he adds, I do understand how it works to a point, but I'm a little frustrated by it. The number of tournaments, the way you play, the calendar thing. Is there any talk of this being adjusted, or is this ranking system here to stay? Tom, we've talked about the ranking system a lot, but I mean, is there any conjecture that goes on in tennis circles? Fans and media talk about it sometime, but is it a big deal? Like, do players and people in the tennis industry think it's fair?
Oh, I think everybody thinks it's fair. The one thing that comes up is on the women's side, you had Carolyn Wozniacki was number one for a long time without winning a slam for over a year, I think, in total. And that bothers people that you can be number one without winning a slam. But, I mean, that's just the result of the fact that she's a very consistent player. And the rankings actually came in 1973 for the men and 75 for the women. And really, I've heard very little people protest against them. I mean, it's a fantastic way of doing things. In the old days, if you knew somebody, if you wrote a nice letter or you sucked up to somebody, you know, get into the tournament or you get seated or something, this is 100% objective, 100% controlled by the computer. Every week you have a result. You keep the week, keep the result for a whole year. The week comes around the next year, they erase it. You put out the new result, and it's very fair. So, I mean, there's little tinkering things you can do, but basically I think the rankings are fantastic, and you hear very few people protest about the actual way that it's done.
Okay, and as usual, we're out of time. And listen, if you'd like to continue to communicate with us, you can. It's our last edition of Aces, but you can always email me at roger@sportsnet590.ca, roger@sportsnet590.ca. Whether it's a tennis-related question for Tom or just a comment on Aces or next season, whatever you'd like, you can do that. Follow me on Twitter, @TheRog590. Tom's also on Twitter, @TomTebbett, and we would like to keep in touch with you throughout the course of the year, never mind the tennis show season here of Aces. And again, we thank you so much. You had so many great questions. And our mailbag is brought to you by themerchantoftennis.com, celebrating 20 years, merchantoftennis.com, game, set, shop. Well, Tom, we have been waiting with bated breath. I'm sure the people who did the mystery sounder all year and went through it, we kept their names in our bin. We added last week's winner because we didn't have a mystery sounder, but we had another person added in. Who, Tom, is going to take that Wilson BLX racket?
Well, we actually added two spots for last week, so there were a total of 11, 2, 10, and 11 went on last year. We had 1 to 11. I just interviewed Françoise Abanda. I wanted to make it this as fair as possible. I asked her to pick a number from 1 to 11, and she picked number 5. So I looked on our list, and number 5 winner was Sonic Wire.
All right, the guy with the great handle. Sonic, congratulations. You win that Wilson BLX racket. And thanks to everyone who participated in our Mystery Sounders. We had a lot of fun with that. I think it's a great way to do trivia. And we'll do that again next year on Aces for sure, because it makes it a lot more fun. And Tom, let's do one more sounder here. You had one more you wanted to throw out for us. Introduce it, and then we'll play it here.
Well, Rog, I'll just say one thing. If they might recognize my voice, and they might recognize your voice, and they should certainly recognize this voice.
All right. Here's the Mystery Sounder.
It's a little bit different. It's different in the sense we play mostly the same way, but we play quite different patterns. I know the patterns he plays. I know what he's going to try to do a bit. I don't know too well, but what I've seen and when I've hit with him a few times, I know which sort of patterns he favors. But yeah, in general, the game is pretty much very similar.
If you don't know who that is, then, well, you haven't been listening to Aces, or you've been hiding under a rock here. And you know what this shows, Tom, more than anything else, with our good friend Milos, is how far he has come and how far Canadian tennis has come, that we can make a joke about a Canadian tennis player's voice. How about that, eh?
That is great. I was going to say, Roger, that anybody who doesn't recognize that voice can't listen to the show next year.
They're barred? I don't think we can do that. Tom, we got about 30 seconds. It's been my pleasure to work with you throughout the course of the year. We're definitely going to have you in here on a Saturday afternoon and talk some tennis and really wrap up the season again. Again, you can reach us, roger@sportsnet590.ca, @TheRog590 on Twitter. And Tom, your insight on tennis is great. We can't do a show like this without you. And I thank you and Tennis Canada for your support. We had nothing but fun this year, and we'll be speaking throughout the course of the season, and look forward to doing this again with you.
Well, Roger, you were terrific as well. It's you're a fun guy, you're a relaxed guy, and it makes it a lot easier to work with somebody like that.
Well, we have a lot of fun. Thanks so much, Tom, and I appreciate it. And we'll see you on a Saturday real soon. Thank you. Thanks to all our listeners once again. We're just about out of time. Thanks to everyone involved with the show, especially the listeners. Reach us on email, roger@sportsnet590.ca, on Twitter, @TheRog590. Tom and I will be in the studio Saturday. We'll let you know on Twitter and email when that is. For now, thanks again. Thanks to all of our sponsors, and you've been listening to Aces on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.